Okay, so I'm going to begin. I'm Colleen Cook, and I'm the Trenholm Dean of Libraries, and I welcome all of you to a town hall on reconceiving and reimagining the library of the 20th century for the 21st century. What we're about here today is trying to get input from all of you, from all of our library users, on the needs that you have for library services, collections and space, trying to think out to 2050. So there have been three issues that I just want to talk about from the very beginning, and hopefully I can put some people's mind at rest, but I can also make sure that we have enough time to deal with hearing from everybody who wants us, who wants to give us their ideas on how we can transform the libraries for teaching, learning, and research discovery for the mid part of this century. So the first is that we know that people are still smoking on the terrace, and we're trying to do our best for people to be self-policed. We know that that's an issue. We don't like walking through the smoke either. The best thing to do is when you see it, just to remind people that it is a smoke-free area. The second is that we know we have only one entrance to the library right now. It's a matter of, it's purely a matter of budget and security, and I can talk to people about that more at length. But that's not what we're doing today. What we're doing today is asking you to tell us what you need in the library of the future, 50 years out. And the third is I know that a number of the members of the music faculty and the students of music and those of us, all the rest of us who love music, are concerned about Redpath Hall as a performance space. And I would like to reassure everyone that we are quite aware of that. I'm going to ask Stefan, the chair of the Department of Performance Studies, to read a statement from Sean. Sean and I recently just walked through all of this space, and he understands now what we're about. And it's not something I think y'all are partners in this. I think that we can accommodate everyone's needs, and it could be a spectacular space for everybody. So Stefan, please.
Sean, of course, would have liked to be here. He is on his way to Europe right now, so I'm happy to read this statement from him. Sean writes, I regret that I am not able to attend today's town hall discussion on the future of McGill Libraries in the 21st century. I fully support the library's desire to explore new methods and means of delivering their services to the university. Some members of the community have expressed concern to me, often with great passion, regarding a phrase in the library's scope and vision document that refers to the repatriation of Redpath Hall to the libraries as a reading room and exhibition space. Having been in contact with both the library and the university, I'm fully confident that Redpath Hall will continue to serve as it has for half a century as a cultural, academic, and research resource for the Schulich School of Music, the entire university, and the Montreal community. Thank you.
Thank you, Stefan. So I'm going to introduce a few people here. I'd like to introduce Robert Couvrette, who is the Associate Vice President for University Services. And Robert, if you can stand, he is the person ultimately responsible for all of this, as he is for all buildings and such services on campus. And all of those, the feasibility study managers report up through Robert. So I just wanted to make sure that you could place a name and a face. The university has contracted with architectural firms to do a feasibility study. The feasibility study, well, this is the second time that the architects have all come from Shepley Bulfinch, is the oldest architectural firm in the United States. They are partnered with EKM, a local architectural firm here in Montreal. So we have a Quebec partner, and Shepley Bulfinch has a very deep experience working at universities and particularly in reimagining libraries at the sorts of places that are our peers, MIT, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, Duke, just to name a few. They have a very, very deep experience in all of these sorts of, not only renovating his heritage sites in large big cities, but all sorts of reimaginings of library spaces. What we will come up with at the end of this is a series of meetings that will go on for 6 to 8 months, 7 months or so. There will be three options for re-envisioning library spaces and services, and then a decision will be made to do very large design work of large-scale design conceptions of what this might look like after those who are in decision-making authority at the university decide which one that we like the best. They like the best. So I'm going to quickly introduce Jeanette Blackburn, who is with Shepley Bullfinch. She will introduce her team, and Francois Imond from EKM, who will introduce his team. And I will turn it over to Jeanette, and she will show you a small presentation. It will help you get an idea of what we're all about. Thank you.
Thanks, Colleen, for the introduction. As Colleen said, I'm Jeanette Blackburn. I'm a principal at Shepley Bullfinch, and I have with me here today Jay Verspeek and Barak Yaryan, who are both architects and my colleagues at Shepley, and you'll be hearing them speak a bit today as well. And then we have Francois Imond from EKM, and he has with him Andy Covina and Raquel Pinosa, and that's all you have with you today. And they are not only well-established architects in the city of Montreal, but responsible for some of the design work in this space as well as out on the terrace, right? This space. Yes, this space and the terrace. Yes. So it's been a great partnership, and we're really pleased to be working at McGill. So I'm here to start to show you some pictures about what we're seeing in terms of libraries in the 21st century and the range of issues that surround those, and to play back a little bit of what we've heard so far from McGill in the way of themes. We were here, I'll just start here with a little bit, first of all, about each of our firms. This is some of the work of Shepley Bullfinch, as Colleen mentioned, working across North America, a bit in Europe, projects that reimagine libraries and learning spaces. They tend to keep the tradition and the identity of the campus, but also speak very strongly towards new initiatives that affect learning and research. And EKM, you see the space you are in, as well as other scenes from McGill where they've been working. So we were here about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and we met with maybe 150 or 200 folks on campus. We met with a couple of student groups. We met with library staff. We toured each of the libraries. We met with some of the deans. And so we are starting to get a little bit of a flavor of what your group, your community is about, and we're looking forward to hearing more. We're now at the second meeting, so this is still very much the beginning. We're listening, we're gathering data, we're gathering input. We don't presume to have the answers or even understand everything yet. We'll be continuing to work through this process through into the spring term, and we'll be on campus, I think, a total of 6 times. So as we think about the library from our perspective, we're really, because we're an architectural firm, we really are looking very much at the spaces that the library occupies. And what we find is that many libraries, including this one that we're in, were really conceived in an era where a library had three distinct pieces. It was how to find space for staff to do their work, how to create places for people to read and use collections, and how to house the collections themselves. And what we're finding in the 21st century is that a library is much, much more dynamic and indeterminate, and there is no one-size-fits-all. There's no one model out there for what an academic library should be. And not only does it need to change in terms of the very, very wide variety of activities it may encompass with each institution, but it changes and evolves over time. So we're looking at models that have a great deal of emphasis on all kinds of user environments, not just reading. They have many, many auxiliary resources and amenities, cafes and event spaces and exhibit spaces and performance spaces that complement what they also bring in terms of resources that are not only print materials but also technology resources. And that's what makes it so exciting to start to imagine what this library could be in the 21st century and what types of physical changes really need to happen to keep on to what is really good about this complex, but also to remake and rethink the parts that are not so flexible and don't serve you well anymore. So just these are just a few environments that we're seeing in libraries. Certainly much more emphasis on creating collaborative workspace of all types, enclosed space, open space. You know, this space and many of the others that that have been renovated in this building recently address some of that, but our sense is that there still needs to be more. We heard a lot about that from students last time we were here. And then those combined with spaces that still emphasize the importance of the library as a place for inspiration, for contemplation, to be alone, to do your work. The image on the right of Johns Hopkins University, they are actually going back into their main library and creating new classic reading rooms for that kind of quiet signature space that's associated with a library that have maybe disappeared over the years. And then we're looking at collections as being a much more complex diagram. There are certainly still the need for the visible presence of books and browsable collection, but those are being complemented with a whole variety of new high-density storage systems, from compact shelving that you're probably familiar with to robotic retrieval systems and kind of warehouse-type environments that store very, very large amounts of infrequently used collection that needs to be maintained over a long duration of time. And what we're finding is that almost every academic research library of the size and caliber of McGill that we're working with has a combination of these. They have both print materials in their libraries, and they also have the high density, the remoter storage areas to just be able to maintain the quantity of collection that they want to have available in a way that is achievable and efficient and appropriate for their campus. So then in addition to print resources, we're also seeing that libraries are bringing in, through partnerships with information technology and other groups on campus, many, many more robust technology resources, visualization resources, places where gaming can happen, where simulation can happen. And they're doing that because when those resources are in the library rather than in a department, they become available to all. So they're trying to invest in technology in a way that it is available and accessible uniformly across campus. These images are of the new library at North Carolina State University. And they are also bringing in many more blended services, many more spaces for teaching, for partnering with academic support services such as a writing center or a math lab. And this happens to be a space at Duke University that is used for teaching space during the day, and at night it's opened up for group study, for collaborative work. It's the 24/7 space on campus. And then we're also seeing a lot of research partnerships. At Johns Hopkins University, the software that is being developed by the Whiting School of Engineering, which is a motion sensing software, is being displayed and tested in the library. So that aspect of sort of engaging with the community beyond the walls of the library, but bringing into the library examples and connections with the resource across research across campus. This is at Duke University. Again, this is a cafe that they've created that can also work as an event space that creates a very lovely space to study as well as to meet. It brings faculty and staff and students together in a common gathering space. So those are some of the things that others are doing. We are also have started to gather and reflect some of the feedback that we heard from our visits here a few weeks ago and organize it into themes. So we have the theme of access of all types, discovery. Certainly a library is still a space, a place of discovery. It always will be, it's becoming broader in terms of the types of discovery that can now happen there. Variety of spaces and the identity, really thinking of the library as a place that is distinguishable as a center at McGill. So in terms of access, Jay, do you want to speak a little?
So just the question of access, we heard a lot about that the last time we were up and the fact that, you know, you kind of have to loop around the campus and to go into one door, the difficulty of just even finding the front door. But beyond that, entering, once you enter the front door, you know, how are the resources made visible and the wayfinding within the library clear so that there's a kind of understanding of all the resources that can be available. So, and even thinking about libraries less as, I mean, this library really is quite an introverted building. You're either inside the library or not. Where can there be those overlaps where things like exhibit and events can be kind of part of the front door experience or open, extrovert, more extroverted and open to the outside world? And then apart from that, how can we think about, you know, spaces upon entry that just sort of allow that ability to understand and read what all those resources are that are in the library.
The next theme. Yeah, and just the two examples there. The top one is the images of the Brody Learning Commons at Johns Hopkins, and the bottom one is at University of Delft, right?
Yeah. These are the main spaces. So you enter, you understand right away a kind of range of availabilities.
Yeah. So the next scheme, next theme was discovery. We talked a bit about this, about discovery being very broad in terms of certainly encompassing a range of print resources and technology resources, and really becoming a place where there are spaces where interdisciplinary groups can meet, where people can come together around research. They have at hand the expertise of the library resources. The image on the top is at University of Calgary. It's a facility in their library, a visualization studio that provides opportunities to work with a very, very large high-resolution display for all types of academic research. And then variety, I think the one thing that is constant on all the libraries we work with is the appreciation for a very large range of variety in terms of spaces to study and to work, from classic reading rooms. Again, this is a new reading room that's been created at NC State University, to smaller scale nooks that will support either group study similar to what you have here. And so one of the things, you know, we've observed in McLennan is that as you go from floor to floor, there isn't really a lot of variety. In order to be as efficient as possible, there's kind of one space type in there. You do have some variety in some of your branch libraries, which is really lovely. And we really heard a lot about having that, if you're going to spend a lot of time in the library, having ways to move and to change your outlook in your environment.
So I just wanted to talk a minute about the question. This is a theme that came out as well, the notion of identity of the library on the campus. So just how does the library, what is its meaning in terms of the overall campus as a place for people not only to work, and through it being a sort of a shared space for work, how does it then become actually a something that builds community? And so thinking about the meaning of that and how we can be creating a public place for the community that is secure and comfortable. And so images on the right really here are a project we're doing at, in Richmond, Virginia, in addition to a very kind of defensive building in the 70s, creating out of it something that's much more transparent, much more visible. Well, from the outside, you can see kind of the activity within. Reading rooms on the top floor that become destinations, campus that invite the campus in. So and so the idea of sort of the campus, the library as a kind of a focus or hub on the campus. Coming back to McGill itself, I mean, we want to be very careful to understand what is special about McGill, and the complex that we're in is part of a heritage of buildings that have happened over a sequence in time. It really kind of is an embodiment of sort of the history of library design through the late 19th century into the 20th century, and as we look at Old Red Path, which is a beautiful building, much of it has been buried. Are there ways we can be revealing it and bringing it, it, actually embellishing it and making better use of it? And also, as we look into the future, understanding, you know, that this is a kind of a collage of buildings, this complex, and what is this next sort of 50 years? What are we bringing to this site that really represents the next 50 years of McGill? And so it's about, as much as anything, hopes and aspirations that, you know, what does this university want to be?
Okay, and that's the end of the prepared presentation here, and I think, do we have a system for how we're going to open up for comments and questions? Yeah.
People can queue up at the two mics, please, if you have questions. And what we'd like really is for you to give us your input on what you think, what do you want the library to look like? What services do you want in 50 years? How is this? I know that you're leaning into your crystal ball a little bit here, but just give us your ideas. We're here to listen. That's all we're doing right now is listening. So if you go to the microphone and queue up that, we really appreciate it.
Yes. Hi.
It would also be good if you just said your name and what discipline you're in. That will help us.
Great. And if you're a student or faculty for me, thanks.
Yeah. My name is Adelaide. I am going to be graduating with my Master's of Library and Information Science at the end of this year. I'm hoping to find a job in an academic library. And I guess the main thing I pulled out of the presentation was that the learning commons are great spaces, but are they a library? Mm-hmm. Is the use of all this technology in a building that we associate with books and text and the written word really the next step of libraries? Because the one thing that I noticed in all of the pictures is there were no books. Mm. Nowhere.
Oh, no, that's not true. There must have been some books. There were books on the collection slide.
Yes, books on the historic slides. But as someone who will be working in libraries for the next 50 years, I feel books are still a very important medium for students. And the importance of serendipity browsing versus having a call number in mind and going to the shelf and getting that book, or having a robot get that book for you, you kind of lose that magic of finding something in the library that really can kickstart your research. So I'm just wondering, like, how the books will be addressed in the changing of the libraries, because I also know that I've been learning in my classes that libraries are becoming more of these learning learning commons, and so the books are getting shipped off-site, and you have to request them, and it takes a while to get printed word. So I guess that's just one of my opinions about what the library should still have as someone who's going to be working in a library.
Yeah, that's great, and it's a great observation that, you know, I would say it's, we'll have to get more slides with pictures of seats next to books, that it's not that the books are all going away, it's that there's so much more that's being added. And then how do you balance all those resources where there are disciplines where almost none of the scholarly research is done using print resources, and there are other disciplines where it's still very heavily dependent on it. So for the library, it's the challenge of creating that flexibility and that diversity that balances all of those needs. It's really important. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Oops.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Robert Doucette, and I'm the stage manager for all the music events that happened in Redpath Hall, the 150 or so concerts. And trying to look forward into the future, it is a spectacular space. It's one of the nicest buildings on campus, and we're constantly getting requests for how can I rent this space? How can I have my event in this space?
Yeah.
And the answer simply is there's just too much going on in that space right now.
Yeah.
So to try and reimagine, to look forward as to how we could possibly share this space as a performance space, as a rehearsal space, as a recording space, as a space for events such as Iron Ring, which is a very Masonic ritual where the engineers get their rings and their cards for gas discounts and whatever else they get. I just honestly, I don't have time. My office is there. I rarely there because I don't have time to be in there because organ teaching and practice is going on. Or special events is setting up the book fair, or you know, or I've got to run between two halls because you know there's two or three rehearsals that day for a concert the next night. Or I know that you want to hear what we think the library should look like, but this statement was a bit of a bombshell. The repatriation of Redpath Hall. It sounds a little bit like you know Russia repatriating Ukraine. Just.
I didn't make the statement, first of all. Second of all, I think everyone here appreciates how heavily used Redpath Hall is. And what we're looking to do is not negate any of the things that are happening there. And obviously, you can't move the organ because it's integral to the space. And you can't have a reading room in a space that is acoustically designed for organ performances because it will be too resonant. So I think what I really would like people to help us with is that is an incredible resource on campus, and what links could there be between that space and the library if it stays as a music event and performance space, what supporting things might the library have that could work in concert with it to create a stronger identity for both uses, library and the music performance space? It's there's a lot of libraries that are now combined with those sorts of performance spaces and event spaces, and they are very, very successful. Things that come to mind for me are, for instance, exhibit space that the library has, links with humanities programs that are exploring music and art and culture, and how could those start to be paired with the events that you have happening there? I think it's an incredible resource that you could start to strengthen as part of this. Does that help?
Well, a little bit, but I think what would settle a lot of certainly the music faculty and students' nerves is just how you saw the sharing of the space. If it's not a completely taking over the space and turning it back into a reading room, and yes, we know it was originally the reading room, But I heard that back in the day that everyone didn't like it because it was too resonant. But how do you see the space being shared? That's great news to hear that you see concerts still happening there.
Yeah.
And obviously this pipe organ that was a gift to the university has to stay there. You know, morning is the reading room and evenings are concerts.
No, I don't think you can use it as a reading room if it's designed as a performance space because the acoustics of the two spaces are at odds with each other. So I think that what would be happening is a partnership around examining that event and performance schedule, and you know, it should be full all the time because it's such a fantastic space. So if it's full all the time and we understand that there are rehearsal and teaching needs related to the organ usage that also have to be accommodated and can't be accommodated anywhere else. So I think it was never in my mind that we would share the space in terms of literally trying to put library reading and study functions in that room. I know it was in an RFP. I didn't write the RFP. What I do think would be really powerful is to create links so that you have this incredible event and performance space and you have incredible library cultural resources that are adjacent and that Redpath Hall then gets rejuvenated because it's now accessible and visible not only to music but to library and through the library.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Another person for music, Marta De Francisco, professor of sound recording.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And another of the uses of Redpath Hall is the use as a recording and research in sound space.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it's essential for us. This is not just a place where organ rehearsals and organ teaching takes place, which is very important, but it is a place or not only for concerts and performances, but also a place where we do recordings. We are dependent on the acoustics, on the large acoustics of this space for doing the recordings. It's not something we can do somewhere else. We cannot just take equipment make ourselves comfortable in a corner in a dry space. It's a performance. It's just something that's essential, the acoustics of that large space. So we're all very concerned with the possible perspectives of this space being changed acoustically or being taken away during the day and only open for performances, because we also do teaching and we do research, and so it's for us it's absolutely essential.
So noted, and we do understand the sensitivity of the acoustics of the space and that changes to materials or configuration or even furniture could upset the balance of a concert hall.
Yes.
Or for acoustical research space.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
My name is Catherine, and I'm in both literature and music. I have a double degree, so I'm very torn because I have a great loyalty to the libraries at McGill, but also to the concert space. And while I totally hear what you're saying, and I understand the sensitivity will be maintained, I do worry, and this was just one of the things I noted in the presentation, that in our anxiety to make spaces useful in a number of ways. Mm-hmm. We make spaces that are jack of all trades, mm-hmm. master of none. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And some spaces are spaces for concerts. And because they're not, it's a musical performance isn't an exhibit. Mm-hmm. It's a performance mm-hmm. that requires the space. And a library is oftentimes a place to get books and to be quiet and read and non-interdisciplinary when you want. It is a place of discovery, but it's also a place of study.
Uh-huh.
So I just...
Yeah,
I understand, but I just wanted to make that fear known.
Right. I think that's important, and it speaks to that point about variety and creating those places, maybe I didn't say it clearly enough, but for deep, focused research as well as the places that are for more casual interaction and, you know, balancing that among the study spaces. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Adam Finkelstein from Teaching and Learning Services. I'm not going to ask a question about music, so if there's anybody else who wants to ask a question before I divert it to something else. There's an interesting phenomenon, I think, at McGill and any urban campus where we have lots of different connections with identity. So one of the bullets you had was that the library is the backbone of the campus. And in many ways that is true, but we have disciplinary neighborhoods that are very, very interesting, where we have sectors of campus where people are intersecting in lots of different informal ways. Mm-hmm. We have residences, we have both residences on campus, we have off campus, and when we have the city of Montreal, all surrounding, competing sort of for that identity. Mm-hmm. So my question is that, you know, one of the things about changing from a library to a commons or a learning hub or learning space is to include more members of the community that were originally thought of with a library. One of the things is I wonder, when the books leave, will the faculty also leave coming to the library? Mm-hmm. And I think there's a question of how can we ensure that the library maintains its backbone by having an intersection point where students, faculty, and staff, mm-hmm. I would not want to leave that out as well, as an intersection point to talk about and to discover learning. So how can we sort of work through that and still maintain that given all the different competing identities we have?
I think that's a great point and one that we should spend some time researching.
Hello. My name is Andrea, and I'm a librarian here. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that one of your major themes is access. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to put out there that I think it's really important to involve people with different experiences and needs mm-hmm. in every stage of your planning process, mm-hmm. Specifically people with different disabilities. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to point out to everyone in the crowd that we're actually in a fairly newly renovated space that's not physically accessible.
Yeah, and this building that we're in, this section of the library, is very challenged in terms of levels and access and connections, and those are certainly some things that we'll want to look at as we look at new proposals.
Hello, my name's Alexander Elias. I'm a cognitive science student, and I speak on behalf of the 800 McGill students who are enrolled in the Facebook group Open the Red Path Doors when I say that the correct decision was unfortunately not made regarding the closure of the doors, but it's easy to reverse. And I call on the library to please somehow, I understand the budgetary pressures, et cetera, but that door is more important, I think. I think there are ways to accommodate, given the schedules of the security guards, to add some hours. You know, I think it's not infeasible to find the savings to keep the door open, and it would be a great benefit to all the people in this community.
Great, thank you.
David Lank, I'm a professor emeritus and a director emeritus. When they built this building, in the flush of enthusiasm, did they anticipate being able to add 3 or 4 floors to the existing structure without having the whole thing fall down?
Do we? No, they didn't.
McLennan is capable of...
Yeah.
Oh, it is. Okay, so how many more floors could you add, assuming you had the money?
Two.
But this structure...
No, okay. So
there's two things that factor into it. One would be, of course, budget, as you mentioned. Yeah. The other is the city zoning stipulations. And we are doing an analysis of all of that to understand the potential.
Montreal politicians can be reached.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
Hi. My name is Sue Laver, and I am the director of the McGill Writing Center. So I actually feel a little bit spoiled right now because you actually did mention the Writing Center writing centers in general in your opening remarks. So unlike people in Redpath and the Faculty of Music, it seems as if the Writing Center is being reimagined as part of this new development. I just wanted to stress that we also think of writing as a kind of heartbeat. It's the common activity of work at universities. And of course, there's a natural relationship, one that we have explored very successfully with the library, between research, mm-hmm. study, and writing. So we're currently located in Redpath, mm-hmm. and one of my questions is, there are a number of units, in fact, who are currently occupying library space, And so my question is procedural. Mm. Will there be a point at which the people occupying those spaces will be involved in consultation, any decisions that might be made?
Yes, absolutely. I think we're up very high, and we're trying to address all these things like that to make sure that they are attended to. So thank you.
Okay. Yeah, great. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Joel Peters, and I am studying organ here at McGill, and as well as I'm a student of philosophy. I have two questions for you. Yeah. The first is in regards to the budget. We've heard a lot of things about we can't keep the buildings open, we have all these projects we can't finish. How is it feasible to begin a new project with the current budgetary restrictions, and especially with the email sent in fall with the vice president saying how we need to address budgetary issues in a new way, and this is a challenge. Mm-hmm. And yet we're coming into this new architectural challenge that is extremely expensive and extremely ambitious. And my second question is in regards to the favoring of some kinds of education over others, mm-hmm. why the current space, which is used for groundbreaking studies and mm-hmm. performances and is used extremely well, and why this is getting shifted to the side, and why, what is the justification for replacing this space?
So let me take your second question first, and I believe that I already made it clear that it was not on my radar screen that we would take the organ out of the performance space or change it into something other than a performance space.
Yeah, I understand that. I would like, though, an example of a library with an organ.
Well, wouldn't it be cool if so the spaces, as I understand, administered by the music school or the music mm-hmm. department, and it's a central campus resource. So, yeah, I don't think a library would be managing an organ. There probably is an example if we looked hard enough, but that's not what's being proposed here at all. And in response to your first question about funding, I just also want to do a bit of expectation setting that we are at the very, very beginning of exploring what might need to happen. We are nowhere near an architectural project that is going to start to accumulate dollars and resources. And I think it's really a duty of leadership of an institution to, even when financial times are difficult, to continue to look towards the future and to have plans and aspirations in place so that when they are possible that they can be moved forward on. Otherwise, you can't keep a place relevant and vibrant. So I think that's what the administration is trying to do by moving forward and starting some conversations about this.
Do we have justification for the removal of the performance hall?
I didn't say that we were going to remove the performance hall. I'm not sure where you're picking that up. I thought I'd said clearly, actually, several times that that's not what I have understood.
Sorry, my mistake.
Thanks.
Hi, my name is Stephen. I have spent my studies at McGill and my whole working career in and around McGill. I have a question in terms of, and I appreciate the comment you've made a couple of times that you are really at the very, very early stages, yeah. Probably below ground floor uh-huh. in terms of any kind of plans. One of the things I think about from time to time relates to McGill's heritage materials. In other words, those things that McGill has that nobody else has in the world. How does sort of that mm-hmm. fit into yeah. your plans? Yeah.
That's a really great question. I'm so glad you brought that up because the special collections and archives, and you have some tremendous ones here, are becoming really, really premier collections and very strongly linked with the institutional identity at most of the campuses we're working with. And so we would expect that type of attention to those spaces here as well.
Thank you.
Tremendous potential, yes.
Thank you.
Peter McNally, the History of McGill Project. I come today wearing two hats, actually, one as the university's historian, the other one as a member of the university's Heritage Committee. Mm-hmm. And the Heritage Committee is in the middle of a massive project evaluating all of the university's buildings from a heritage point of view. And we're in the business of classifying them in terms of their priority. And I say this in the background that we're in a province and in a city that takes heritage very, very seriously. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the city of Montreal has some very, very definite ideas about ranking heritage buildings from a heritage point of view. We have three buildings here, basically, the old Taylor Redpath building, the Size building. You mentioned, I think, three architects, but the real architect was a man by Size. And this 53 wing of Redpath where we are now is considered to be one of the outstanding examples of post-World War II modernism. And then McLennan Library, which, of course, what can we call it? It's brutalist architecture. But as brutalist architecture goes, I want to assure you that it is generally considered to be an outstanding example of brutalist architecture. Now, having said all this, there are these elements of classification. The heritage classification is not meant to be necessarily a straitjacket, but the fact of the matter is that the historical, aesthetic, design qualities are, I would suggest, also elements that in your organization, in your pattern, in the elements for you to take into consideration, I would suggest is also on something else which is should also be considered. These buildings as historical objects. Yeah. And particularly with these two wings of Redpath Library, which are so dramatically different, but yet it's very hard to imagine that one could honestly argue that one of these sections has aesthetic or design priority over the other. And they're a funny mixture, but the truth of the matter is that in itself, this has ended up becoming a monument, and what you call it, an art of, as an artifact, of something of significance. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Kari Polani Levitt. I'm an emeritus professor here. And when I saw the announcement about the designs for library and archive, I decided that I would come to ask a question about the archive. Mm-hmm. And because I want to tell you, 4 years ago, the director of the archive approached me and asked me if I would consider archiving my entire professional, personal life, since whenever, whatever material I might have. And that project began, and it went very well. Mm-hmm. And then for various reasons, which we don't need to go into, on the McGill side, on my side, you know, not much was done for a couple of years. And when I returned to this project, I was devastated to discover that the archive has no staff. There was a somebody acting as head of the archive, but it seemed that there were no human bodies there to continue with this work. I now have 75% of material in the archive and at least 25% that is not. I really came to ask if, in all of our new technology, we think we really can dispense with people.
Well, not in terms of... certainly not when we're archiving paper. I'm not a librarian. I'm an architect, so I will, you know, maybe turf that to another conversation at another time that you want to bring up with... library leadership about that.
Well, perhaps somebody from that department is present, and I would like to speak to them. We mentioned heritage. I don't believe that my work over 50 years is an important part of heritage, but nevertheless, I do believe that the archive also consists of the work of various professors that have passed through this university mm-hmm. over all of these years. And if you could assist me to put me in touch with somebody who could assist in solving this problem, I would be grateful, and I think so would other people in the same situation as I am.
Sure.
Just contact me. I will help you. Colleen.cook@mcgill.ca.
Okay, so I want to make sure that we're hearing comments. The topic here is what you need from the library, what you think the library should continue to provide and provide that it isn't providing now in terms of the study and research of the institution, things that would be good for all here. And so I want to make sure that we get through a variety of topics here. Who else would like to come?
All right, I wasn't going to ask another question, but I figure I will.
Sure.
You know, coming from a teaching and learning unit, we are particularly interested in classrooms, and we're particularly interested in improving as many classrooms as possible as we can on campus. So I can look up at the six floors and the hundreds of thousands of square feet and imagine phenomenal classroom spaces that could be used for our faculty and for our students. So my question would be is that how do you envision us as a community coming together to sort of determine what percentage of space will be used for what and how, what the most equitable way that you as an architect who've done a lot of different other spaces that you've gone down that road?
That's a really good question, and we're doing some benchmarking now to understand and identify all the needs and then the most pressing ones. And so, you know, we'll have more information on that as it evolves. Yes?
I'm Gwendolyn Owens, and I'm responsible for McGill's visual arts collection, which includes the portraits in Redpath Hall. And I had something to say about nuance in your presentation that's a suggestion. There are lots of examples that you give that I think are interesting. I think I was hoping to hear more in the examples is how you work with a faculty when you design a gaming area or something like that. I wasn't hearing enough of that. I'm sure you did. It's just a suggestion. And also, the more that I think I'm an art historian, the more I hear about how like institutions also resonates with me. So an example from Hopkins feels to me stronger because I know a McGill student, someone coming to McGill might also be applying to Hopkins. So if we're comparing like with like. So that's my other suggestion.
And we have been doing some benchmarking with like institutions. With regard to interaction with the faculty, every library project seeks faculty input that we work on. And we started that with some faculty groups at our last meeting out here, and we'll, you know, continue to be seeking faculty input. Starting at a high level now and then becoming more specific as we move into details of spaces. Yes.
You mentioned the special richness of our special collections.
Yeah.
And every university prides itself and helps build its own identity around. There's a reluctance to share sometimes, but with the advent of distance learning and with the electronic technology that's available, how do you see getting other universities that are facing the same kind of problems and McGill, how it's going to share its richness without losing its identity?
What we're finding is that as institutions start to make their special collections digitally available, it's actually increasing use. It's increasing awareness of the resources, and it's increasing an interest in wanting to see the real, tangible artifact. So I don't see the digitization and the online learning as something that that damages identity. I see it as something that increases awareness and is an opportunity to showcase that uniqueness.
Hi, my name is Catherine Peterson, and I am at the Schulich School of Music. I'm just wondering, you keep saying that you did not write the statement that was released, and I'm curious who wrote the statement and why it was released before consulting with the Schulich School of Music. If you could please address this.
You know, I've let me take responsibility for it. You know, that's probably just the best way to say it. When you write a scope and a vision, you're just trying, for a feasibility study, you're trying to say we're going to explore what is the best for the community as a whole. It's not, there have been a number, I've been here for 4 years, there have been a number of times when we have all talked, many of us have talked about how we can, all universities, all universities strive very hard to be excellent at what they do, and their spaces are incredibly important to them. What we have to do here at this incredibly symbolic space on campus is to make sure that we honor all of these needs together, where good people, smart people, with goodwill and reasonable people come together, you can do a whole lot. And that's what I ask everybody in this community to do. Libraries only exist for users. We are here not to alienate anybody, not to take over anybody's space. Libraries only exist for everybody. You know, all of you belong to us. You belong to your faculties, but all of you belong to us. That's really just all I can say. I can't, you know, we talk about provenance in libraries along a lot. I don't know where the provenance of those exact words, so aim it at me. Okay? But I can tell you that Sean Ferguson is, the deans are all pretty close. I mean, we really are, with a couple of them here besides me. And we talk a lot. We aren't enemies. We compete in a very friendly, established way because we're all community citizens in the end. We have to be very strong advocates for our own spaces, and we are. But in the end, we make things work, and we are respectful of one another. And that's where Sean and I are, you know, so.
Hi, my name is Duncan McDonald. I'm a music student at the university, but actually my question isn't about Redpath Hall. what I'm asking about is your past projects at other universities and the deep storage that you've undertaken there. Mm-hmm. I assume that that's not just taking materials from just one library in particular, but from right. all the other branch yeah. libraries in that mm-hmm. university.
That's right, yeah.
How did that affect the other branch libraries? Because yeah. we've been only talking here about McLennan and right. Redpath, right. that complex, yeah. but I assume a deep storage kind of facility would take material from all the branch libraries.
Right.
So how would that affect the other libraries, yeah. and how would those spaces yeah. be... right. reimagined.
So we haven't really started the mm-hmm. numbers analysis, mm-hmm. but you know the process is that the library will look at very low use materials that mm-hmm. they need to move out of central libraries in order to create space for things that need to stay in the libraries, whether it's more frequently used print materials or more seating space or more technology or whatever. So, you know, that's how that balance will be achieved. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's not a plan to take the entire collections of some library, including really heavily used ones, and just take them mm-hmm. all off campus. It's much, much more nuanced and, you know, looking holistically at those pieces.
Yeah. Do you have an example though of how that like at one university sure. how that changed? Like, did some branches
sure. yeah.
change more than others?
Yeah.
Or
yeah. So, for instance, we've been working at Brown University on a similar study, and Brown has a humanities and social sciences library. They have a standalone special collections library, a music library, and a science library. And the science library encompasses life sciences as well as medical school health sciences collections. The health sciences collections, the print collections are very, very, very low use. The majority of the resources they are using are electronic. they have, you know, some use, obviously, of historical collections that are only available in print. They actually, what they did was take about 30% of the sciences collections in that science library and move those into off-site storage to open up more space for carols for medical students who didn't have libraries and didn't have offices and needed focused workspace. And then in the humanities and social sciences library, it was a much, much, much smaller percentage. I don't have the exact number, but much smaller because of the disciplines they were promoting, they had a much higher use of print materials. Mm-hmm. So that does that help?
Yeah,
with the illustration?
That gives a bit of an idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, so thanks. It'll be that kind of analysis.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
Radoslav Zuk, emeritus professor at McGill in architecture. Uh-huh. I had a question. You've shown all these university libraries. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering whether you looked beyond university libraries. Mm. I had experience of working several times at the British Library in London, mm-hmm. the New British Library. It may look like a Far East Club Med from the outside, but it has a wonderful variety of distinct spaces, the identity of that wonderful collection of books which you see at the entrance. Yeah. And I can imagine a concert hall fitting into that complex as well.
Yes. I
hope that you'll look beyond the North American Eastern Seaboard continent, because the examples that you've shown, I was sitting very far away, they all look sort of like the same kind of contemporary plastic, glitzy thing, and I hope that maybe my colleague spoke of the heritage of McGill, maybe that could complement and enrich the future project. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
John Grew, Professor Emeritus and University Organist once upon a time. I love what you said about using collections to show inside and get inside. We did this when we opened the hall, or reopened the hall, I should say. Peter will remember it, Fran will remember it. The organ is a copy of a French classical organ from France. This is New France, it's not Boston. And I have relatives in Boston, so no problem with Boston either. Except we were allowed to sing and dance and have organ music, and you weren't.
Exactly.
The 175th anniversary of Montreal is coming, 2017. When we opened the organ, the exhibition was called Témoin de la vie musicale en Nouvelle-France. And this brought many materials from our wonderful collection and the archives. You've spoken about them. And maybe this is a question of staff or lack of staff. We did it twice, actually, in the 80s. And the curator of that, Elizabeth Gallimorin, went on to get a PhD in musicology and write several books, and has become quite famous as a result of that exhibition. The exhibition, the catalog still exists, it's in print, and this was wonderful. We found things, I think, Fran, was it Eric Ormsby? I'm trying to think. Was it Eric at that time? Or maybe it's before Eric. I'm just not sure. Oh, yes, of course. Right. So that's, of course, when we reopened the hall, which had been closed for 7 years, the speaker was Dr. Stanley Frost, and the hall was designated in that speech as the University Ceremonial Hall, thanks to the gift of the organ, which was anonymous at that time. So everybody knows subsequently it was Dr. Huntington Shelton, who has been a great benefactor to McGill and to Johns Hopkins. So there is a wonderful thing here that happened with that exhibition, and I think it was we then remounted the exhibition in the McCord Museum a few years later, and we actually took it to Quebec City. So I'm just thinking 2017, the 375th anniversary, Montreal, and we have a French organ, which at that time was unique in North America, and gave us a head start in many ways and put McGill on the map in other ways. And our archives are a rich, rich source. So I'm just thinking out loud, can we remount this exhibition again and bring people into, through our exhibition, what you've just said, bring people into what we're doing in music. It's a whole cultural thing, and the thousands of people that go through Redpath Hall for musical events and ceremonial events every year.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, it's really a shame with it. Redpath Hall is such an incredible resource that there's not kind of it's the way it's now as a library has grown, kind of just positioned as the tail end. It feels a little remote to the central campus green, and if it could be connected with some of those sorts of cultural spaces, I think it would really strengthen the visibility of Redpath Hall and the use. So, it's a great idea. Yes.
Hi, my name is Fernanda Macchi. I'm associate professor in language, literatures, and cultures. And since you were asking about what we wanted to see, yeah. One of the things that I think that you mentioned, that I wanted to reiterate, is that they need to think the space for the use of rare books.
Yes.
I think that the library, now it's clear that it needs that, and thinking a new design is fundamental not to overlook that. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is a question, that I imagine you have the numbers, and I was wondering, what is the percentage of space used now for books and for people, for readers, yeah. for usage, now in the library, mm-hmm. how do you think that will be in the new design?
Yeah.
And if there is a trend, if you could share some numbers
sure.
from yeah. other universities.
Yeah. yeah. So anytime you give someone a number, it's stuck in their head for a very long time. I would say that, let me start with sort of a typical 21st century library model, and my guess is that McLennan Redpath is pretty close to this. It's about 50% of the space is used to store print collections, 25% is for staff, and 25% is for seating. We did an analysis of all 60 libraries at Harvard University one year and measured the spaces allocated to each of those three categories, and they were remarkably consistent because they were all really had their primary development in the 20th century. What we're starting to see libraries do, and again, you know, there's differences with disciplines and institutions and all kinds of things, but they're starting to shrink the collection footprint through looking more critically at how they're using central campus space. They're not shrinking the collections. They're shrinking the amount of space they're using to store it, and they're reducing the amount of it that's stored on the central campus in order to create more space for user seats. So not more staff space, but more space for people to study and work within the library. And that's the trend we're seeing. We have universities that are going to the point where they're flipping it. So they have 25% for collections and 50% for seating. And we have many libraries who are not able to do that, but they're maybe at something like 30 to 40% for collection, and the balance goes into seating. So, you know, there's not a sort of new 21st century formula, but those are the kinds of trends we're seeing. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think that we are going, the new version, ambitions to go 25% for books and
I have no idea. We're nowhere near understanding that yet. Yeah. Yeah, that would be like MIT is at about that. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Carolyn Samuel. I'm with the McGill Writing Center. In a library of the future, I would like there to be better temperature control across the rooms, very simply, and also better air quality.
Yes. So noted.
My name is Barbara Lewis. I work at University Services. I'm staff, and I'm also on the same heritage committee as some of the other people mm-hmm. who have been speaking today. When these three structures were originally built, this was a road. A traffic mm-hmm. road. And it may not be evident now, but I'm sure you're aware that it no longer is. It's a pedestrian area that we're hoping will become more and more open to a variety of activities and making this kind of a student corridor for student services and student mm-hmm. activities. So mm-hmm. I'm just raising that as something that I hope will be kept in mind because yeah. it wasn't part of the idea when these buildings were first built.
Right. Yeah, we've talked about that. It's really important to understand how all the floors at street level relate to the surrounding campus pedestrian and vehicular routes. Yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
Ahmer Wali, medicine, first-year medical student. I just want to, in terms of what the library would be like in the future, when I first came to McGill, I went to McLellan Library and both the Islamic Studies Library, and both struck mm-hmm. me as very different spaces, but mm-hmm. they were both very awe-inspiring to mm-hmm. someone who hadn't mm-hmm. been to a lot of libraries before. Mm-hmm. And I would like the libraries in the future to retain that, mm-hmm. to be spaces that inspire, that are events and in and of themselves, that are monuments that people everywhere can look up to. So
yeah.
just amazing in terms of architectural vision. That's
yeah. That's great. Really good vision. Thanks. Yeah.
Since we are here speaking about the library,
yeah.
I was wondering about food.
Uh-huh.
What are your thoughts about food in the library? And perhaps we can share our thoughts about
sure.
food in the library. Why not?
So, yeah, I'd love to hear everyone's thoughts. My own personal thoughts are I really hate it when the library smells like fish or Chinese food. But on the other hand, when I study and work, I like to have a cup of coffee. I sometimes like to have a snack. I think most libraries are trying to strike a balance with you know, maintenance and having things that aren't smelly, but recognizing that people spend very long hours and they sometimes need food. I don't even know what the policy is here, but some libraries are trying to contain food to a certain area of the library. Some, you know, certainly you would not want it in special collections or archives or anywhere where you have rare materials. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I truly don't know any library where you can eat anything. I cannot think about one, and I've been around my libraries. You know, in general, they have a space. I do believe that for students and for professors, mm-hmm. it's very important to take a break, to go outside. Mm-hmm. It's not good to eat in front of your books. Not good for the books, not good for you. And, yeah, I'm sure of that. And, you know, so I think that in a project, when we can imagine a new space, I think that we should imagine a space where students and professors could eat healthy food that is not in front of the books. Because I personally truly believe that the space of the library should take care of the books. Mm-hmm. And we know that the books and the food do not go together. And it's not very nice when you are trying to read to hear people eating, you know, things that make noise, like apples or celery. And they are perfectly healthy snacks, but I truly do not like that. But I think that we should discuss it openly because it's a very important topic. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah. So, hi, my name is Lawrence. I'm a U3 political science student, and I'm also a student representative on the SSMU Library Improvement Fund. It's very clear that, yes, books need to be protected, preserved, etc. But you address different kinds of spaces, quiet spaces, learning spaces, all that. Why not have a mix of spaces where you can eat food and spaces where you can't eat food? Mm-hmm. For instance, right now we have landings where there are garbage cans and recycling facilities. We should open these up and allow food. This is something, as students, that we're trying to address, and that's something that needs to be looked at with this. And I think people can have a balance, and we're all university students. We've all worked hard, and I think people can respect the rules. So if you say this side of the door you can eat, this side of the door you can't eat, I think people will listen.
Sorry, I have one more thing about from the perspective of a student now who's been in university for 6 years. I find that with a lot of the, I've been at a university that had recently had their library redone for my undergraduate degree, and they had a lot of open spaces, but those spaces echoed. So when you're trying to, it's like the exam hall, and you hear someone's chair scrape, and suddenly you're snapped out of concentration. So I'm just wondering how the beauty of the large open atrium will be feasible for people who want or need this quiet study space that they wouldn't get elsewhere.
Right. So the acoustics of the space have to be taken into consideration, and when you have a large space like an atrium space, you have to be really careful with the balance of absorptive surfaces. So acoustical absorption on the ceiling, on the floor, areas that need quiet may be glassed in, so there is visibility but not open. You can balance it with white noise. To put an atrium in a library, you do have to do that acoustical analysis to understand what you're going to get. Really important, yeah. Has everybody had a chance to speak? We have 10 minutes left. Anyone
also,
else?
Knowledge creation, things like maker spaces, things like creating knowledge, because a lot of people come to the library to actually create new knowledge using existing knowledge. Is that going to factor in heavily on that?
Yeah, and we didn't talk about that too much tonight. I think we talked about it some last time when I met with you. A lot of libraries are starting to bring in, it's a part of that piece about technology and resources that everybody needs, try to bring those out and not have those just buried in a single department. Like there may be a 3D printer in the engineering building, I don't know. But, you know, but should that be, many libraries are starting to have those at schools that have intensive engineering and architecture and, you know, programs, disciplines that have a lot of making. They're starting to bring those spaces into the library because those are needed not only by those disciplines but by other students as well, and because the library has maybe the longest hours and is therefore most easily able to keep those accessible. I think I will say at McGill that you have some very, very pressing space needs in terms of collection and seating. And so there is not as much wiggle room at McGill to bring in all kinds of auxiliary resources and amenities into the library as there might be on other campuses where we worked, where they're trying to figure out how to get people to go to the library. So you don't have that problem. We wouldn't expect you to have that problem at McGill, but it does make, it's kind of a slightly different balance of being really making sure that we use every square meter very, very wisely for the most pressing needs. So, shall we close then? Is that okay? Yes.
Just one more thing. Maybe if you could address, because we've got this town hall, what the process is going forward. In terms of what you guys are doing on your end and how that's going to be shared with the greater McGill community.
Sure. We haven't, we may want to get back to you because we haven't really designed that with McGill yet, okay. but there will be opportunities for feedback about the
options. So more town halls will happen in the future, I think. Yeah. That's good.
Yeah. Okay. You think, Colleen, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah. Oh, I'm also supposed to show the slide with the website for comments, right?
Right.
there for more information. They're getting some things set up.
Right. Please send in your cards and letters. We are here to listen. That's what we're doing right now. The worst thing that could happen with this project is that we hadn't listened enough. So that's what we're trying to do. Please tell us your thoughts. Tell us what's on your mind. And really try to lean into your crystal ball and think of 50 years out. And right now, don't worry. Don't think about money, okay? This is daily operations of universities are funded entirely different from construction projects. I mean, this is a multi-year process. I hope that you are just parents and not grandparents by the time this is done. Okay. And I hope it's not nearly that time frame. But we have to begin somewhere, and McGill only does this once every 50 years. We have to get it right. So we're in a listening mode, and please, please pay attention to other opportunities to give us your input. And thank you all for being here for a very long time, and we've gotten a lot of input, and it's because of you that we've gotten it. Thank you.